This is Greenberg's argument that the focus then is more and more the overall, the flattening. This actually is representational. Do you know what this is image of? Anyone guess? You've seen it before? Some? You know what it's about then? It's a representation of the water opposite his hotel in Holland. You know this? Yeah? And it's called Pier and Ocean because the pier is those longer vertical lines at the bottom here, and that's the pier, and the rest is the moonlight surface of the water. Okay? So the ripples are where the water moves around the pier. So it's just about the water surface. Yeah? And of course, Mondrian begins to be sort of think, okay, how can I make the whole canvas equal? So it blurs out here, but it becomes a big issue to flatten into an equalized canvas. And all of these are stories you could have a whole lecture about, but what happens next with Mondrian is an interesting question. But Greenberg's story is then a linear progression story, very strong in this ideas of modern life and culture. It leads from one place, goes to someone else. With Greenberg, it's semi-abstract, moves to pure abstraction, like this one called Lavender Mist. And it's all about the performative action of Jackson Pollock. And again, that slide is, it's actually quite a pretty work, very beautiful. But it's the interplay of these colours and forms and lines that are not representational at all. You see, just to show you, there is modernism behind the scenes, there's real people. Greenberg in the middle, with the child, his wife, who's also an artist, and Helen Frankenthaler on this one here, who's also an artist, and Jackson Pollock, who's the moody, sulky guy on the beach. So they were all quite good friends, and Greenberg's theory really fits his friend Pollock. But then Pollock did works like Blue Poles that eventually... Greenberg didn't like this because it brought in totem poles and had this representational reference, so it seemed to be no longer a linear thing but going backwards, so it didn't fit his theory, so they had a big falling out with this sort of idea. So it just goes to show you these theories of from one point leading to a long, simple linear progression don't work that well for modern culture. And then Greenberg, later in life, supports a different type of abstraction called colour field painting. Well, just a couple of quick problems with this idea of Greenberg. I just finished the lecture now by explaining what's wrong, I think, with Greenberg's definition. And the best place to start is, what is the avant-garde? It's a French word, okay? And it comes from this guy, Saint-Simon. He's not because he's a saint, he's a thinker, a social reformer in the 19th century. And this idea of the avant-garde or the vanguard simply for him meant a whole range of social forces. Scientists, artists, engineers, anyone technological, innovative, forefront. Right at the ahead of society, willing to look at the new changes and innovations, okay? This was the original idea. It wasn't artistic, it was a more social program. We call it today, I guess, progressive forces of society. The avant-garde is, again, a military term. Like a lot of our technology, it comes from the military. And it literally means the forces that went through and broke the enemy line. So bang, they'd break through. This is where the term comes from. It gets translated into this idea of being ahead of, being at the front. And then translated into the people who are willing to exceed the limits, to transform life, breaking rules, And this idea becomes quite important because some of these ideas of breaking the rules eventually become accepted. So certain women who sort of exceeded the limits, and then women's voting becomes quite important, almost, you know, something no one would argue about today. These are all battles from breaking the rules, being audacious at one stage. But where Saint-Simon was really focused on was because modernity was not just disruptive to those who did well out of it, but it was creating a lot of terrible social effects. Poverty was one of the key things Saint-Simon was talking about. The class distribution of wealth was so unequal, and the key thing about people's poverty and child labour in 19th century England. Just to show you too, there are also people who are almost, what you say, countercultural. There are modernists who are anti-modern. The expressionists are more like that. They're very much like the hippies in the 60s. They wanted to drop out. They didn't want to be part of modernity. They wanted to go back to a pre-modern almost life. Their style is very modernistic, but they were thinking about different forms of life or possibilities that preceded modernity. Nearly all of them were nudists, for instance. They were naturists. They wanted to go into the countryside, and the idea was that modern life was making everyone too regimented, too stiff. You had to go out to the countryside, be in the sun, be naked, and you could become part of nature again. Someone who was totally opposed to this view was Marinetti, a famous Italian provocateur. He famously called himself the caffeine of Europe. What he meant, he was like the cup of coffee you had in the morning that woke you up and got you going. Marinetti thought he was the energy of Europe to bring it into the new age. He was particularly didn't like Italy. It was not modern enough. It was too focused on the past. It was too much about museums and wonderful old culture that was dead. Italy hadn't done anything for centuries, he was saying. We want to be modern. We've got to wake up. So he was very much a positive side of modernity. Both these responses are responses to a similar thing. One would see this situation as modernity. You've got to go back before it's a terrible mess. Go beyond it. This idea has been very strong. It was very strong in England too, with the socialist movement, particularly people like Ruskin and Morris. But this idea is the other side of the coin, is someone like Marinetti. We're not modern enough yet. The problem is we're not modern enough, and that's where you have these problems. Marinetti was also always very early on a sort of a militaristic figure. When people experiment and think about new ways of creating subjectivities, there's often a lot of weird things happen. Marinetti was a poet, and he very inventively looked at abstract sound. So sung tung tum was the sound of the machine gun firing out of a plane, shooting the Ethiopian soldiers down below. So it was Abyssinian, sorry. It was the a moment of Italian imperialism where they were taking over in North Africa, and this was his sense of what the sound of these bullets were like. Sang tum tum, sang tum tum, sang tum tum. So he makes a poem about it, so you can see the bullets flying down through the air. Another response then to this is Tatlin. Tatlin was worked in the Merchant Navy, and he was interested in not so much about paint. He was a sculptor. He was not really interested in sculpture either. He wanted art to be part of the social and to be taken off from the wall and become part of the streets almost. He created this monument, and it was a monument to a new type of socialist government, a universal government that would be for the whole world, that would leave behind class conflict, and was this monument to a different type of world. And this compares it, what it would have looked like in against the cityscape of its day. What he does is create two spirals that go like this. Start like that, and they go around each other, like this. Round, like a slippery dip or an amusement park. And they're meant to be like dialectics, the thesis, antithesis, and they go around, and then they resolve near the top. But it then is like a rocket ship to launch off to the future. So it's this very utopian future, and this bottom section was a Congress Hall. So it's made out of a cube and a cylinder and then a sphere. And the last one on top was a media center. But the scale of this was incredibly large. Tatlin was working in a period where Russia was very poor, very impoverished during the Civil War. But he was also doing things like the idea of art being part of everyday life was to, this is a close of his own design. And his influence, of course, was the Eiffel Tower, one of them. There was this idea of these structures that were just purely engineering. They were seen as not having very much ornamentation, just very much as it is. It doesn't represent anything, it's just about its own construction. And another aspect that he uses is the Baku oil fields, which he saw in his travels. It's an area where, remember, the stages of industrialization that I mentioned at the beginning, and from the steam age moving to the petroleum age, and Baku's this oil rigs, which could have been another factor in what informed his structure. And here you see the structure then coming together into this monument shown in a May Day parade. And the cube space was meant to be a legislature, and it moved around once every year. And then you've got the sphere, which moved around every 24 hours, and the one was once a month in the middle. So it was this great kinetic sculpture, it was an engineering thing, it was a new thing. So this idea of the avant-garde is very different to Greenberg's idea. It's a coalition of all the arts, including architecture and design. And one of the key things of the early modernists is they felt that you could, they were looking for a recipe, basically, to bring all these various experiments together to create this new aesthetic future. I think that's what differentiates that period, maybe the first half of the 20th century, to our period. And I'll talk a little bit more about that tomorrow. This idea of finding this future, putting everything together, you take everything apart, you put it together again. This is what Tatlin was trying to do with his tower. And here is the idea that you're looking for this thing to make everything cohesive again and to produce this new modernity. It took its cues from design and architecture. Paxton was not necessarily looking for new architectural designs. He was trying to fulfill a function. But his famous Crystal Palace was created this excitement because it set up these new possibilities, new engineering, technical possibilities. But also creates a form of dislocation, as I've mentioned. Modernists photographed places like this, the machine halls. Machine halls were set up simply to display goods. There were lots of expositions, okay? It's the beginning of all the expositions that perhaps culminated in the Shanghai exposition last year, Expo. So these originally were to show cultural goods, design, engineering goods. And a lot of these early modernists were particularly the ones interested in design and architecture and arts, took their cues from these sort of technological transformations. And the most famous, I guess, is the Bauhaus. The Bauhaus wanted to bring all the arts together, theatre design, architecture, everything, and they created this place. This is in Dessau, the second aspect of the Bauhaus. The first one was in a place called Weimar, the capital. And it was very much committed to this goal. bring all the arts together will create the transformation of society where mass production, mass consumption can alleviate poverty. So one of the first things they started working on was workers' housing sites. The idea was that the aesthetic would be embedded in the house. The house itself would be aesthetically made. It looks sort of very serialized now, but it was completely different transformation compared to what workers' housing was like in Germany at that time. Most of it was seen as unhygienic, poorly functional, etc. So it was an idea to try and create affordable housing. This is sort of one of the key topics still today, affordable housing. Here you see a more sort of up-to-date photo of them. They still exist, they're there in Dessau, much more small scale. So what I want to end up talking about then was this emphasis on progress, and it has positive and negative effects. It creates utopians, like the Bauhaus, even Greenberg was a utopian of some sort, but it also has dystopian elements, the whole idea of what is this modernity, what is it creating? Is it creating a sort of a, is it uncontrollable? Can it ever be controlled? Have we unleashed something that just cannot, like a genie comes out of the bottle, it's some monster that you can't contain anymore? So there are all these aspects to it. The ones I've tried to show today are examples that explain these key aspects of modernity and what this culture is like to live with, to live in and to respond to. And tomorrow I'll try and explain, there's still people looking at these sort of ideas of the futurist tomorrow. This is a recent work by two Eastern European artists, but it's very much a joke, a sort of ironic look at their own recent history and these ideas of this march into the future, this sort of linear progression. So this idea of let's conclude, it's like the end of this story.
Well, Mamanda 教授谈到了这一个话题是现代性和现代主义的这一个话题。关于这个话题呢，我在这里的介绍还有九个方面啊。第一个方面呢，它是关于现代性和现代主义的定义是什么啊？他谈到了这个现代主义。 是现代性的一个方面。那么现代性它含有这样如下的这个含义：一个是 driving force， 就是驱动啊；第二一种呢，就是 abstract of everyday， 就是每日的抽象化，还有这个工业化，还有对于时间的新的观念，还有这个世俗化。 还有理性化，就是马克思韦伯提出的一个理念，还有大生产，还有这个群众性的消费，就是马尔克斯等等，还有第七个方面就是信息交流的新的方式，等等，它可以涵盖这一些方面，这是他谈到的这个第一个方面。 第二个方面谈到还有这个现代性和现代主义的另外一些方面，还在如下，还有国际跨国际间的这种合作，新的发展方式，他这里用这个上海的这个例子，这个就是这些导致这个城市的这种现代城市的出现，这种大城市啊，这种人口，它以人口为例，比如我们上海。 1990年到1520年这个人口的增长，从100万到这个500万，到现在1700万，就是形成了这一种呢 mega city，mega 就是那种巨型的那种城市，这个城市呢一个主城市北京、上海、广州，然后它的卫星城市，我刚才说像我们闵行区，以后可能就是一个卫星城市。这是第二方面啊。 第三个这个谈的这个现代的这种文化经验，他说什么叫做这个现代呢？他是从一个拉丁词叫 model， 就是 model 就是新的，它还没有这种呢永恒的这种变化啊。比如说咱举例子，像这个老式的这个转盘式的那种变化机，在我们当地的时代，它已经就不用了，是吧？然后这个里面所隐含的，它就是有 innovation， 就是不断的创新，对那种传统 tradition 的这一种的超越，超越。第四个方面，他讲到，他就这个就讲到这个每日生活的抽象化，具体是什么东西？他谈到了这一个技术成为了我们这一个日常生活中的不可缺少的部分。他谈到那个银行的例子，那银行以前为了防止抢劫，所以银行做得很坚固，是吧？你也看不到左一层门右一层门。现在这个银行技术改进了，银行它是玻璃的，那个玻璃你可以看到这个银行，但是你看到它的那种资金的运转，这全是一个全新的一个安全观念，我们日常安全观念的一个转变啊。然后第五个变化，它谈到这个我们的媒介，我们的这个特别是通讯媒介，由传统的这种同步型的，像这种不同步型的，因为同步型的，我们两个人讲话，我给你面对面讲话，这是同步的，或者是打电话也是同步的。但是现在呢，它就发生一个非同步的这个你说最原始的是有一个 message， 你放在那里，但是你什么时候看，那随你。但是我们呢，交流者和接收者是个同步的。email 它是变的，对吧？我发了一个 email， 为什么 email 这么流行？它实际上 email 是给人的一个选择权，我不一定在这个时候非得要接你的电话。你说这个电话是跟我烦人的事情，是吧？给你一打过来，你在开会，我不得不接，是不是？有时甚至给他洗澡啊，不要讲了，你回去洗。所以这是讲这个，这是一个实际上是一个我们交流的一个方式的转变。如果是一种同步型的交流，那我们活跃于这个交流，就眼神的、行为的，甚至服装的，是不是？你不可能今天跑到这个会场来你光膀子，是不是行吗？但是你发出邮件的时候，你光着膀子给你发出邮件，是不是？不没人管，是不是？或者是这个，所以呢，这是实际上是一个我们现代性的一个生活方式和技术通信方式，一个也是一个理念的一个转变。第六个方面，他讲的一个modernism， 就是现代主义啊，现代主义它就是它拥有这一个它不是它与可以一种 dialectic， 它就是一种辩证法式的现代主义呢，它与这个现代性呢，它要脱离于现代性，但是呢，又要用现代性的这一种呢创造好这个 creative。又不能够脱离这种创造你又是有摆脱，但是又不能够脱离它这种创造。它具有这种 cross disciplinary， 就是跨学科之间的，比如说艺术和这个音乐、建筑之间的这种跨学科性的这种交流，还有一些这个现在的一些 key theory， 就是一些主题，那比如这个很多的这种法国的这个一些画的一些。画就是一些有抽象的、印象化的这一些画，都是颠覆了那种传统的我们那种传统的观念啊，对于艺术、对于生活，是吧？比如说我们传统的这个观念，艺术我们是要模仿生活啊。我这里有一个水杯，是这个样子的。那么你画家如果画这个水杯是一个方形的水杯，那你就是和我们模仿的传统的观念就好像颠覆了，那你就不像。那是根据这个传统的从古希腊来的这个 mimesis， 就是模仿这是传统的。那么现在就认为我可以画这个瓶子是方的这是我的一个新的理念，但是我原始时你知道这也是一个水平但是我有一个新的观念，我要颠覆这个对这个现实模仿的这种理念这是讲到这个方面。然后他讲到这个波德莱尔在里面关于这一个 Stroller 和 Dandy， 就是一个 那种流浪者啊，在这个城市之中，他四处游荡，但是他也是光照者。他既是离开了教，但是呢，又在任何一个地方呢，又找到了教啊。这就是一种呢，这种struggle for everything 啊，可能在中文要翻译的时候，可能这个流浪者还不那么好。一个更好的词语，但不是完全那种流浪者，因为流浪者他是一无所获，这个很无数人叫这个人，他是一种现在这个人，就是你走到北京，我就是就以北京为家，我到了纽约就是纽约为家啊。但是我是一个四处流浪的人，流浪的人，但是我也是一个世界观的人，是一个这样的新时代的这种角色。然后第七个方面啊，就是关于现代性对于时间的理解啊，关于时间的理解，我们可以是要丢出来一种我们那种线性的时间啊，从开始、中间、结束，或者是 circular 这种呢，都有不是这种时间观念啊。所以它就有出现了这个生产性的时间，还有休闲啊，因为我们这个旅游文化产业里面最强调的就是一个休闲。那么这个休闲呢，就是说它不一定就是要从一个周末开始，我从哪一个点，我想从哪个点开始，我就可以停留在这里，是吧？这都是背景，就是现代性的一些这个理解。然后第九个方面啊，关于先锋啊，第二个方面就是这个先锋呢，就是这个 reform， 就是社会的这个 reform， 就是这种变革者。当然就是先锋，它这个原意当然就是这个法语讲的是突击兵，先驱，这个就是先遣队啊。那么然后呢，就形成这种文学、技术、美学、批评的一种理论，就是它突破一种这种限制及一种 limit 啊。因此呢，尤其是要达到一种呢新的美学指向未来的这一种呢有先锋性的啊，一种创造出一些新的，又包括一种。它是西，就是最早的前沿的具有这个颠覆性意义的等等等等都是这些涵盖在这个大众里面。第十方面呢，就是它维稳，这个现代性和现代主义还有一种双重性。它这种双重性，所以呢，它既有这个肯定的发展，也有否定的你比如说这个它既有肯定的一面，也有否定的一面。它既有这个 utopia， 就是这个不同方式的，但同时也有解构于不同方式的 BCN 的作品啊。我这个不知道这个汉语怎么翻译，就是去不同方化，就是不是不同方的。一方面它指向这种未来啊，一种美好，一种极致，一种完美。但实际上一方面呢，又是一种呢非未来的，就是不是那种不同方式的，也是那种世俗的不是美好的。乃至庸俗的现实的工业化的实用主义的，就是在这个现代性中呢，都包含这些没有这种双重性。以上这个十个方面呢，我结合向大家介绍一下，以及与大家共同学习。谢谢大家。